The United States is expanding its opportunities to help Ukraine strike deeper into Russia. There is apparently a possibility of an incredibly $90 billion new weapons package, at least according to Zelensky, from the United States, on top of whatever Europe may do. We'll see where that's going to go, as peace seems more elusive than ever, and the possibility for expansion in the Russia-Ukraine war is a growing realistic possibility. Now then, we see that the United States is providing Ukraine with intelligence for missile strikes deeper inside of Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we have to go back to what you were just saying, that the administration was trying, or said it was trying, to get peace in Ukraine. But it never really, I think, understood the nature of the conflict or its complexities. And when they talked about peace, I think what they really meant was freezing the conflict for a certain period. And that was not really ever going to happen because it wasn't acceptable to either side. So I think they've now dropped that. But because they haven't come to a view to push forward to a more all-embracing peace, what they're ultimately inevitably doing now is that they're drifting back into the failed policies of the past. And it's important to stress the failed policies of the past, which is constant escalation. We've had continuous escalation in terms of the war ever since it started in February 2022. We've had artillery, missiles, more missiles, aircraft, deep strikes into Russia. We're now talking about deeper strikes into Russia. Why do people think that that will work when everything else that has been tried up to now of that kind has failed? It's not going to force the Russians to the negotiating table. It is going to make them very angry. It is going to make them more determined to see this war through. And of course, it is very, very dangerous because it is now quite openly flouting their publicly expressed red lines.
And, you talk about expanding and all these different categories, you know, and then the F-16s was, I guess, the latest big one. Mm-hmm. Complete bust, didn't do anything at all. Made no difference, not even on the tactical front, much less the course of the war. But now then we're seeing the possibility, at least it's being talked about, to where Volodymyr Zelensky as President Trump, if he can have some Tomahawk missiles. The Vice President J.D. Vance was just asked about that a couple of days ago.
Our simple message right now, the Russians are not gaining a lot. This war is terrible for their economy, and they have to ask themselves how many more people are they willing to kill for very little military advantage.
But would you be okay with them having Tomahawk missiles?
It's something the president's going to make the final determination on. What the president is going to do is what's in the best interest of the United States of America. I'll let the president speak to it, but I know that we're having conversations this very minute about that issue.
So what do you make about that? Now, first of all, I just want to show you here, Jennifer Kavanaugh, who's actually going to be on our show tomorrow, as a matter of fact, says that Russia's likely laughing off Trump's open door to Tomahawks because the United States, as she says in there, we don't have enough of them, and it's not something that would be conducive to bringing anything to peace. But the fact that it's being talked about is I think some troubling. What is your view on even the conversation about Tomahawk cruise missiles?
Well, I think it is a disastrous idea. First of all, the Tomahawk missiles, as you know a lot better than me, it started as a strategic system. When I was young or younger, I remember how they were being deployed in Britain with nuclear warheads, and they were going to be used against targets in Moscow, in the Soviet Union as it then was, and this created enormous amounts of protests. And so this was originally designed as a nuclear-capable system. Now the talk is of deploying it to Ukraine. And bear in mind that when the Russians launched the special military operation back in February 2022, one of the issues they were bringing up then was the fact that the United States, if Ukraine entered NATO, might station missiles like the Tomahawk in Ukraine. And we're doing it. Now, you know, this is exactly what the Russians have always feared. They might not be particularly worried about the Tomahawk as a conventional weapon. And I have never forgotten a point that you made on one of the programs that we've done together on this channel. You pointed out in that program that the Russians have been launching missiles, not that different from the Tomahawk, against Ukraine night after night, week after week, month after month. And that hasn't won the war for the Russians, that Ukraine is much smaller and Russia is much bigger. So if what hasn't worked for the Russians in Ukraine in terms of winning the war there, why do we think it will work for the Ukrainians against the Russians, especially as Tomahawks are apparently not in unlimited supply? But anyway, put aside for the moment the military capabilities of these weapons, which do exist and are real. For the Russians, this clearly crosses a red line. It is something that is going to convince them that all talk about negotiations and compromise is pointless, because already the Americans have crossed their key red line. They have inserted these medium-range missiles in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, and if there was any, I almost wonder if maybe there's not any doubt about that in Moscow anymore. And you don't have to look too much further than earlier today in Denmark, in Copenhagen to be specific. There's a conference there where a lot of the European leaders, Volodymyr Zelensky and the Prime Minister of Denmark, were all sitting around talking not about how we can bring this war to a peaceful conclusion through diplomacy, but through more military means. And the Prime Minister kind of led off, really laying the foundation for where all this talk is going.
I know that for some of you, the threat from Russia is very clear and very present. For others, it still seems further away. But none of us can no longer be naive. The war was never just about Ukraine. It is about Europe, all our nations, all our citizens, our values, and our freedom. And please just take one look at the history of our continent. From the expansion of the Russian Empire to Soviet tanks rolling across several borders during the Cold War, shattering hopes of freedom. And recent history tells us the exact same story. So why shouldn't it happen again?
So let's delve into that, because she makes some pretty big charges there. First of all, she said the war has never just been about Russia and Ukraine. It's always been about all of us, our freedom, our territorial integrity, the whole continent. It's like this whole dam of this Red Army is being held back only by the little Ukraine right now. So we've got to help them. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, the thing that immediately struck me about those comments is that, of course, she talks about Europe. She talks about Ukraine. She talks about the Russian Empire and its aggression and all of that. But she never talks about Russian security and Russian security concerns. And unless and until that fact is addressed, we cannot have peace. Now, this isn't something that Europeans ever want to hear or ever want to understand. Russians are only ever a threat. They are never people who are entitled to guarantees for their own security. And this isn't a realistic view. And it's not going to lead to any outcome that is going to end the war. Because if you won't accept that the other side has a point of view and a right to a point of view, then you cannot ever have a realistic discussion with them. And that's why you drift into the whole extraordinary rhetoric, the Russian Empire, the Tsars, the Red Army crossing the borders. He never talks about European armies crossing into Russia.
Well, that's where I was going to go next, because she brought up history. So I'm like, okay, you brought it up. Let's talk about that. Because, I mean, in terms of who's invaded whom, West or East, I think that there's a lot more with, I don't know, a guy named Bonaparte and another guy named Hitler. I don't know if you're familiar with those guys. Certainly they are on the Russian side. So when we're talking about history, how does that play it out both sides together?
Well, I mean, you know, the Russians don't apparently, I mean, their share of history. And of course, the Russians are part of European history. I mean, this is a key thing to understand. I mean, they in the world wars, they were allies of the West in defeating aggression. They were allies of Britain in defeating Napoleon as well. They are absolutely a part of our history. The wars that the Russians were involved in were European wars in which the Russians themselves became involved and were drawn in. So, you know, simplifying this, disregarding the complexities of European history, seeing us only as the victims and the Russians only as the threat, as she is doing, is a crime against history. It completely disregards the realities of the last 100 years. It ignores what actually happened in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s, and who was responsible for all of that, and the tens upon tens upon tens of millions of deaths that arose from that, and of which, of course, Russia bore a disproportionate proportion.
And, you know, and if you have a really slanted view about history, and then that forms the core of where you are now, then it stands to reason that your prescriptions for how to fix any current situation is also going to be flawed. And I think we see that in the very next thing she said, which she's talking about peace here, but see if your ears hear something different.
Peace with Russia can only be achieved through strength. We have to strengthen Ukraine and weaken Russia with more sanctions. We have to be able to finance the armed forces in Ukraine. All of us have to deliver more weapons, more ammunition, and we have to do it faster. Nowhere it will make a greater impact for European security than at the front lines in Ukraine.
You see, literally everything she talks about there is nothing but more ammunition, more weapons. The only path to peace is through force, and we'll bring in sanctions, ammunition, weapon systems, longer range strikes, whatever we have to do. There is only one myopic view, and that is more war, and more war. How can we ever find peace in this environment?
Exactly. I mean, that is not a call for peace. That is a call, exactly as you described, for more war. It is for a prolongation and escalation of the war. And some of the sanctions that are now being talked about, like, you know, confiscating Russian assets, seizing Russian ships or ships trading with Russia on the high seas, once upon a time, they would also have been classified as acts of war. On the topic of seizing Russian assets, the assets of the Russian Central Bank, about a year ago, there was actually an article in the Financial Times saying, please do not do this, because doing it blurs the boundary between war and peace. But that is what we seem to be determined to do. And it is beyond understanding that people cannot see this, especially given that we're talking about a war which we have failed to win for 3.5 years and which we are not going to win, and which everybody seems to understand, at least at some level, that we're probably actually losing.
Well, you say they're seeing it at some level. I'm not sure that's the case, because I just can't see how month after month we keep showing conferences and meetings and discussions by the highest leaders, and they keep saying the same thing, even though what we see in the air and what we see on the ground in Ukraine continues to scream the opposite, which is you just laid out there. And listen, if anyone's under any confusion about where the whole group is going, that's that standard set off there by the Prime Minister of Denmark right off the top was jumped on by Volodymyr Zelensky, who's in this clip here. You'll see he says both the issue of this is, you know, we're like the bulwark against all of Ukraine or Europe. We're fighting for you guys, and there's only one path to peace.
The recent drone incidents across Europe are a clear sign that Russia still feels bold enough to escalate this war. And it was never just about Ukraine. Russia has always aimed to break the West and Europe in particular. Today, their strategy is simple: to divide Europe, to ignite arguments to prevent us from finding common ground. And I believe we must do the exact opposite of what Russia expects. We must act together, and we must act with strength. First, our guys are already here in Denmark, and there are experienced Ukrainians who know how to detect and shoot down attack drones, and they have already begun deploying their mission, and we are ready to share this experience with you, partners, and this is just the beginning, the first step on the path toward an effective drone wall to protect all of Europe. Please, let's work together on coordinated solutions that will make this happen.
So he's talking about a drone wall there, and there's also, we show one of the members of the European Commission just a couple of days ago is also talking about a ground wall and all kinds of things, whether it's tanks, ditches, fortifications, etc. So, I mean, they really seem to be wanting to dig in here. What do you make of that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in a sense, you can actually understand Zelensky because, of course, he is the person who's actually fighting the war, and he can only win the war if you can involve more and more people in it, or at least that's the calculation. So, of course, he is perhaps the one person who has some kind of reason there to be talking in the way that he is. What is extraordinary is that the other European leaders don't seem to be able to see that and don't seem to understand that what is rational and in the interests of Vladimir Zelensky may not be rational and in the interests of the wider people of Europe, let alone perhaps, in fact, including perhaps Ukraine itself. But it's most strange that they can't get this point, that they accept always these talking points and these extreme ideas from Zelensky, rather than, as I said, look to their own actual national interests. Now, as I said, unless this changes, we're going to go on doing the same thing, providing more weapons, providing more money. We provided lots and lots and lots of money, but we're going to provide even more. We're going to cross more red lines and more legal red lines, like seizing assets and interfering with shipping and doing all of those things. And of course, in the meantime, it is not as if our economies in Europe were not already in very bad shape, which they are, but nobody is talking about that. Nobody at these meetings ever talks about that.
Well, and we kind of talk about the groupthink and how so many European nations are doing what seems irrational. Not all of them are. As Viktor Orban, who actually published a ex post here, I think earlier today. Yeah, it was this morning, where he kind of takes issue with some of this. Gary, if you can pop that up there. He says, talking to Donald Tusk of Poland, he said, Russia is at war. Ukraine is at war. Hungary is not. I understand that you stand firmly on the side of Ukraine. Please understand that we stand firmly on the side of Hungary. Your question is, who will win the Russia-Ukraine war? My question is, how can we end the war, save tens of thousands of lives, and provide security for Hungarians? You seek to win a war you believe is yours. I want to ensure that peace prevails. So he seems to be, not seems to be, he is definitely laying down a marker and a consistent one that he is willing to say, I don't care what this groupthink does. This is not in our national interest, and I'm willing to stand up for it. Obviously, Robert Fico of Slovakia is right next to him on this. My question is to you, to what extent do you think other members of the European Union or the European members of NATO may privately agree with some of these things? And obviously, you're not talking about France and Germany and the UK. Obviously, they're the leaders of this other stuff now, Denmark and Finland, some of these other new ones. But in terms of the rest of them, which side do you think they're really on? Because I don't hear much from the other most of the members.
I think privately an awful lot of them believe that the leaders of the European Union, people in Brussels and in the major European states, have lost all reason over this and understand perfectly well that this is pulling the whole of Europe to disaster, and that they privately agree with Viktor Orban. In fact, I'm going to go further. I'm going to say something. I am pretty sure that privately a lot of them have been telling Orban this they're telling him, go on saying what you're saying. Mm. We may, in public, because we're all scared, and we all know that the things that they might do to us, we may not agree with you in public. We might criticize you in public, but privately, we all agree with you. And in fact, I can tell you an absolute fact, an awful lot of that is going on. The trouble is that it is the hardliners who are very, very much in the ascendant in Europe, the Scandinavians, the Balts, people in Germany, though Germany itself is deeply divided about the war, but the political class in Germany is very strongly supportive of it. The same includes France. Political class is supportive of the war. The wider population is not. In Britain, I think it's somewhere in between. Political class also committed to the war. The British population, perhaps not as extreme about it as they are in Scandinavia and in the Baltic states, but also more supportive of Ukraine than you will find elsewhere in Europe. So this, she's not talking, Frederiksen was not talking for everybody in Europe by any means. It's, and Orban is not alone here. Mm. But in time, that may have an effect. In time, it might change things. But for the moment, it's the hardliners who remain in the ascendant.
And certainly among those hardliners, they are probably also encouraging anyone who's going to give some vocal dissent to Orban. And the first in that line is Volodymyr Zelensky, who called out Orban today by name.
And let's also place more sanctions against captains and crews of shadow fleet vessels, as well as against the owners of the relevant companies. And we need to think about placing sanctions on Russian oil terminals and the rest of their mainland infrastructure. We should also support President Trump's call to stop buying Russian oil here in Europe. It's short-sighted to go against the USA. And the guys from Hungary need to hear this clearly.
Guys from Hungary need to hear this clearly. Well, apparently they did. And Viktor Orban, on the sidelines of this meeting, was asked about that exact issue.
Why would you say that the Finns are a sovereign country?
Because they are not.
Why is that wrong?
They don't have money to maintain themselves. We pay the army. We pay the public bureaucracy. We pay the pension. We pay everything. If you are paid by somebody else, you're not a sovereign country. It's not a moral statement. It's just a financial fact, you know.
Are you going to stop buying oil from Russia and funding Putin's war, like Trump asked you to?
Nobody asked me to do so, that's first, because Hungary is a sovereign country. You know, we decide about our energy mix. Second, we don't have any kind of any option. So we have some supplementary line from Croatia, which is minor, but we need a primary pipeline, and the only primary pipeline is Russia, because we, you know, Hungary is a landlocked country. We don't have sea as you have, so it's a different situation. I can't change geography, whatever is the political request.
I love that last thought. I can't change geography, whatever is the political desire, nor can I change economic factors. And from all I've been able to see, it's not just Orban who's just recalcitrant and wants to be a stick in the mud, but it would literally cost them more money to get rid of the Russian oil than it would be to face any potential backlash that he's facing if he doesn't do that.
Well, this is exactly right, and this is true of many places across Europe. Orban is a realist. I mean, you can take issue with him on many things, but on these geopolitical issues, on the political realities in Europe, on the situation in Ukraine, and what Zelensky is trying to get him to do, he is a realist. And as he says, he is a realist who looks after Hungary. Now, we should have people more like that in Europe. The problem in Europe is that the people who are very much in the ascendant are not realists. We've already spoken about how the economic situation in Europe is getting more and more difficult. The economic situation in Britain is very bad. In Germany, it is exceptionally bad. I was recently in touch with people there. But we, our leaders are not realists in the way that Orban is. They want to somehow change the realities through some kind of exercise of the will. I can remember very early on, at the time of the, when just after the war began, when Germany was taking its first steps to stop importing natural gas through Russian pipelines, the German energy minister, Robert Habeck, who's been told by all kinds of people in Germany, industrialists, civil servants, people like this, do you understand that this is going to cost us this and that and the other, that we're going to see deindustrialization processes? And Robert Habeck's invariable answer to all those points was, those are Putin talking points. That's how he always closed down the discussion. By the way, he's now left German politics, and I believe he is in Denmark. Just saying.
Meanwhile, the wreckage of all the economic decisions are still being felt by those very industrial outputs in Germany, and apparently very many others as well. You know, it's not Zelensky. I mean, you can kind of understand why he's saying this stuff, because you know, he wants to push back on this, and probably is a mouthpiece for some of the hardliners throughout Europe. They're probably encouraging him to do that. But one of the other people that are encouraging him is Donald Tusk of Poland. Now, the impression that the nonverbals when Viktor Orban talks, pretty strong. He's very self-confident, very knowledgeable, nearly every interview you see. Now, as we listen to the words of Donald Tusk here, also look at the nonverbals and kind of tell me what you see.
The question is about Viktor Orban and the war. Viktor Orban believes there is no war. I believe there is a war. The real question isn't whether there is a war or not. The real question is who is on whose side in this war. Because war is black and white. When there is a war, like the war between Russia and Ukraine, the question is whose side you are on, and we know whose side Poland is on, we know whose side NATO, Europe is on, and unfortunately, we probably know whose side Viktor Orban is on.
And unfortunately, I wish I had clipped another part of that, because in that exact same piece right there, Orban comes up and actually makes some comments there, again, very self-confident, and you see Tusk in the background kind of going, yeah, okay, because he kind of called him out, not mean or anything, but he just rattled off like five or six facts and then continued walking on, and Tusk is kind of just left not looking really good. How do you read that interaction?
Well, indeed, I mean, I think one of the things to say is that whereas in Hungary, I mean, Orban is certainly facing a major political challenge, because, you know, that is the nature of democratic politics in Hungary. He is still very, very much, you know, the one senses that he's very much the confident person who has led Hungary for many years and led it successfully and has transformed Hungary. In Donald Tusk's case, he is very, very nervous because his government is visibly failing. It is failing in Poland. And he senses that Polish opinion is shifting, and it's shifting against him and more in the direction that Orban is saying. Poland and Hungary, by the way, are very, very, they're not just geographically close, but there's been a very long, deep historic cultural interaction between them. They're two Central European states, both Catholic, which have always been friendly. They've never fought each other, which is a fact that many people are not aware. So what people say in Hungary is something that people in Poland notice. And there were presidential elections in Poland a short time ago. And the man who won them, Mr. Nawrocki, who is now the president, well, obviously, he's not going to completely go against the EU line at the moment, because in Poland, the presidency is mostly ceremonial. But he's made it quite clear that he's much more skeptical about all of this rhetoric. And he recently said, yes, if it is in Poland's interests, I will speak to Putin. which you cannot imagine someone like Donald Tusk doing.
And what do you make of what the Polish Prime Minister said there about, listen, it's just a matter of whose side you're on, because this war, it's black and white.
Well, I mean, you always have people always say this about wars. I mean, this is not just black and white in terms of what how Tusk sees it, but of course he sees it in the way that Frederiksen in Denmark sees it, as a Europe-Russia war, a conflict between the Europeans and the Russians. And therefore, if you're not on our side, because what he means is it's a black and white war, but it's our side, then you are on the other side. It's either us or them. That is what he is basically trying to say. As I said, many people in Poland are not convinced by this. As for it being black and white, well, it isn't. I mean, this isn't perhaps the time to go into the whole history of this war. But I mean, there's been a very, very long lead up to it, one that goes back many decades. And the Russians absolutely have grievances. You may argue that launching the special military operation, starting the war, was the wrong way to do things. But you can't just say that it is black and white.
Yeah, and as I've often said, there aren't good guys and bad guys in this war. There's just these guys and those guys. They each have their own view. They each have their own interpretation. They own their own history. And this thing is being fought here. So everybody has to look at their national interest and assess what is going to make the best chance for peace and the best chance for their country. And I think that these whole black and white dichotomies are incredibly unhelpful and mask all of the genuine, not just gray areas, but just undercurrents and changing currents and things that you just can't view it like that and have any kind of a good outcome. So I think it's really unhelpful. I want to see where we're going from here. So it's one thing for rhetoric. It's one thing for a lot of statements. And, you know, there's been so many of these kinds of things, like the conference going on in Copenhagen today. There was just one for, I guess, earlier this week in Warsaw. So a lot of talk. But the problem is there's also some actions going on here. And I'm concerned about the risk of escalation, whether intentional or otherwise, and kind of just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Because we've got everything from here. France recently has boarded tankers of a suspected shadow fleet for the Russians. As you said, I think earlier in this show here, at one time or another, that was considered a potential act of war and of piracy. But we don't seem to be having a problem with it. Let's take a look at that one first. What do you think of this issue with France has detained a Russian ship?
Well, and Macron has gone beyond that now. He says that this is something we should do regularly in order to disrupt Russia's oil.
And is there any authorization in international law to allow France or any other country to do that?
No. We are not. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. We are not actually at war with Russia, and this is a historic act of war. Now, if I could just give a historical example, I don't remember every detail of this history, but Britain used to intercept and seize merchant ships that used to trade with Napoleonic France during the Napoleonic Wars. And amongst them, they seized American ships, American merchant ships. And the United States government at that time was very, very angry about it. And it criticized Britain consistently. And it was one of the things that soured the relationship between Britain and the United States leading up to the War of 1812. Now, I'm not saying it was the only thing, but it was one of the things. Now, the thing to say about this is Britain, of course, did that when it was at war with France. We are doing this at a time when we say we're at war with the Russians, and then when it suits us, we say that we are not at war with the Russians. So we have no real legal grounds to start seizing ships in this way on the high seas. But this is what Macron now says that we're going to do. And the Russians have already said what they would do in response. They've already talked about setting up a convoy system, using their fleet to defend their merchant ships. One can very easily see how all of this could escalate into clashes on the high seas between their navy and our navies, and how this could quite easily escalate out of control. And of course, there are third parties, because those ships are traveling to other countries, to India, which has a navy, to China, which has also got a navy. So, you know, I can very easily see how this thing could completely spiral out of control. And the frightening thing is that there aren't people in Europe who are pushing back and talking about this, saying, really, have you thought this through? Do you understand what this means? Do you understand what you are proposing? Do you understand what, you know, what boundaries in terms of law you are crossing, and how easily this could escalate into something which could be extremely dangerous and could very easily run out of control? You've got something like that with the proposals to shoot down Russian aircraft if they crossed into European airspace, which again seems like an incredibly provocative and escalatory thing to say, apparently to shoot down Russian aircraft without warning. There might be legal grounds to do it, I don't know, but to do it at a time of when tensions are so high, and to do it in this reckless way, it seems to me to pile folly on top of folly.
Now, one of the other areas of potential escalation that has increased here of late is a lot of the claims in a number of different countries, to include Denmark, to include Estonia, that there have been all kinds of drone activity from the Russians. Is what it's either being implied or outright accused, is that the Russians are testing NATO air defenses. MiGs are flying over NATO territory, all this. And now then there's talk about we should shoot them down. What do you make of all this, this increased activity and claims from the Europeans?
You see, it is also very nebulous and difficult to understand. It all started with those drones, which, by the way, undoubtedly, indisputably Russian drones. I mean, when I saw them, I immediately recognized them as Russian drones, that they drifted into Polish airspace. They were clearly decoy drones. There might have been a malfunction. There might have been all kinds of things. They might have been propelled there by the wind. I'm not an expert in these things. The Russians said, let's sit down and talk about it and discuss what happened and find out what happened. Of course, we didn't do it. We then started this whole narrative about the Russians testing NATO defenses. Nobody explains to me why the Russians, who have their hands full with Ukraine, would at this point in time be testing NATO defenses. Testing them to do what exactly? To march on Warsaw? They haven't gone to Kiev yet. So, I mean, what is the logic and the rationale of all of this? So, again, I get the sense that a number of incidents which might have explanations, which might not be sinister, are being in an atmosphere of tension and hysteria, being talked out of all proportion, built up into something really threatening in order to enable incredibly disproportionate reactions from us, which are only going to cause the tensions to spike up much, much, much further.
And unfortunately, that's not the end of it either. I mean, you've got, I showed you that comment that Zelensky had asked for Tomahawks earlier. Russia says that they warn against the Tomahawks. They say don't do that, or there were going to be appropriate countermeasures. Putin apparently was all over that. You've had Zelensky now claiming that, I've only seen this from some sources, but he is claiming that he's got a $90 billion arms package in the works with the Trump administration right now, about not that they would give it, but that they would sell it and that the NATO countries would pay for it, which would represent an extraordinary escalation. Even the last time that the U.S. President Biden, his last package, it was $61 billion. Yeah. And now, allegedly, there's $90 billion. Now, where that would come from, I don't know over what period of time. But nevertheless, that's what seems to be on their mind. And then you have these issues here that things have been happening on the European side of the line of contact. Now, I'm going to show you something that Friedrich Merz of Germany said just a few days ago about some warnings about what he claims the Russians are doing beyond the front lines.
Drone flights, espionage, the Tiergarten murder, massive threats to individual public figures, not only in Germany but also in many other European countries. Acts of sabotage on a daily basis. Attempts to paralyze data centers. Cyber attacks. I suspect that here in the room, probably every second person has already been affected by how their data networks and infrastructure have been attacked. We are not at war, but we are no longer at peace, and we must be clear about this if we want to meet the challenges we are now facing.
We're not at war, but we're no longer at peace. And he lists all these things. Now, I can't independently validate that all those things he claimed that the Russians are doing are valid, but I can see why they might. But what's problematic in that to me is that there's no connection being made in the European side of all these actions where they are openly helping the Ukrainian people with ammunition, weapons, long-range fires, et cetera, and intelligence to kill Russians. And what? They think that nothing's ever going to happen? I mean, why is that connection never made?
Well, that's an excellent point, because I mean, here we're talking about long-range missile strikes deep inside Russia, talking about supplying Ukrainians with missiles that can reach Moscow. Zelensky has talked about decapitation strikes on Russian leaders. And of course, we've had talk about attacks on Russian oil refineries and things of that kind. So we can do these things. We can supply Ukraine with all these missiles and the intelligence and encourage them to do those things. But if that results in blowback, which affects us, well, that is something that is just completely unexpected to us, and which we then get shocked and alarmed about. Now, all of the things that Friedrich Merz described might be true, but are they really comparable to launching missiles against into another country? I mean, there is an imbalance in terms of what we are doing to the Russians and what they supposedly are doing to us. The danger is that the more we escalate, and it was the response to every Russian move, real or imagined, is to demand further escalation. The more the Russians might feel that they have no choice but to escalate in return. And then, of course, we're going to be in a very, very bad place indeed.
You know, and one of the other near-term issues that are of growing concern to me is at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Now, for those who may not be aware, the Russians captured that early on in the war, and they've had physical possession of it ever since then. But now then we have some claims that Zelensky has been making that the Russians are shelling it, and they're risking a potential nuclear meltdown inside of the of Ukraine, or actually in Russian-controlled territory here. But you see there that more than a week after Russia said the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant lost external power because of shelling, the situation at Europe's largest nuclear power plant is now critical. While there is no immediate danger as long as the generators keep working, it is clearly not a sustainable situation in terms of nuclear safety, said Rafael Mauro Grossi, director general of the IAEA. So this is a big problem here. Now, the dueling narratives between Russia and Ukraine are really, really different. So now, given that I just said the Russians are in possession of the ZNPP and have been from the outset, here is a one shot to put together of what Zelensky is claiming and what Dmitry Peskov responds.
It is the Russians, through their attacks, who are preventing repairs to the power lines to the plant and the restoration of basic safety. This is a threat to everyone. No terrorist in the world has ever dared to do with a nuclear power plant what Russia is doing now. It is right that the world should not remain silent. I held a meeting with the military and the Ministry of Energy. I instructed the government, the Ministry of Energy together with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to draw maximum global attention to this situation.
Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant is under our control, which is why the Russian side is ensuring safety of this plant. As you can understand, it is, to say the least, silly to accuse Russia of bombing a station that Russia is controlling.
I mean, that seems kind of logical to me, but you see the veracity with which Zelensky is claiming that the Russians are, I don't know, bombing themselves on a nuclear power plant? What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I find that completely irrational and impossible to understand. Why would the Russians want to bomb their own power plant, which they control, in order to contaminate, presumably, territory that they also control? I mean, it seems to me illogical. Clearly, something is very, very badly wrong. But again, instead of taking diplomatic action, instead of talking to the Russians, instead of talking to the Ukrainians, instead of sending our own people in Europe to find out what's happening, because this is the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, by the way. And if there is a major nuclear accident in it, it could affect all of Europe, or at least all of Eastern and Central Europe. Instead of doing that, we always act as if anything that Zelensky says about it must be true. And of course, we then support what he demands, which is that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant be handed back to him, which, of course, the Russians are not going to do at this stage of the war. So it seems to me that, you know, we need to talk to both sides, and we need to send our own people to find out what is there. And we need to also speak to Rafael Grossi of the IAEA, whose people actually are there. And for the moment, at least, and I have to say this, Grossi seems to think that the situation is not quite as critical as Zelensky is implying. And the Russians are supposedly creating a power line to this power station, basically to keep the electricity going. But anyway, it's a frightening situation. And it's very consistent with the very frightening situation that we've seen and discussed in this program overall. People are losing touch with reality right across Europe. They don't understand what a very, very dangerous game we're playing.
Well, and let me just ask you that just point blank, just especially in light of all the foregoing, all the things we're talking about here, whether it's the Europe wanting to be on a rearm program, or Mark Rutte previously talking about we have to be ready to fight Russia in 3, 5, or 7 years. Russia building up its forces now that they're apparently going to be at 1.5 million active troops by the end of this year, because they have the largest in 9 years recruitment class, or conscription class, rather. So you see both sides, they just seem to be, one's getting ready for war, one's threatening the other, one's perceiving a threat, and things just keep on moving up. Are you worried that we might actually expand this war beyond the confines of the Ukraine borders?
I think it is impossible not to be worried, because when we hear the kind of rhetoric that we've heard on this program, anybody who is not worried about it and who is not aware of the situation in Ukraine and the fighting that's already going on there and of all of the threats and counter threats that are being made, anybody who's not worried in light of all of that, I mean, I think is being disastrously and dangerously complacent. I still believe that at the end of the day, the ultimate disaster of an all-out war will be avoided. And the reason I think that is because such a war would be so catastrophic for all concerned that I think everybody in the end will step back. And I'm going to say something else. If we're talking about the general mood amongst the people of Europe, the most interesting thing is, despite this rhetoric that they are hearing every day, morning, noon and night, they still are unconvinced and don't want war and prefer that their leaders follow a policy of peace. Every election that's happened in every big European country, Germany, Italy, France, Britain,
Romania,
you can see this, and gradually, steadily, the forces that call for peace are growing stronger.
Well, I hope that version works out, because I also have this unpleasant memory of things that I've read about in the preliminary to World War One, where people were saying the exact same thing, that nobody wants a continental war. Nobody wants all this stuff. It would be dumb. And yet you see that bad decisions and bad leaders can sometimes do the unthinkable, so which keeps me from being too confident. I hope you're right, though.
I'm afraid you've made a very, very good point. And there's a lot about the situation in Europe today, which is frighteningly similar of the situation before the First World War and of the disastrously bad and incompetent decisions that were made then. And I have to say, the leaders of that time in Europe actually look an awful lot more competent, than the leaders we have today.
Oh, that's frightening.
Yeah.
Listen, and then in the last few minutes we have here, I wonder if you can just give us any kind of an update. I saw this morning in Manchester, there was an attack on a Jewish synagogue. And in the current environment with Muslims and not even just in Europe, UK, but with Muslims and the Jewish situation and the things that are going on in the Middle East with the Gaza Strip and all that, a lot of powder keg going on. What's going on and what can you tell us?
I mean, so it's an extraordinarily upsetting and tragic thing, and it is inevitably going to increase tensions. I mean, one of the things is that the Jewish community in Britain it has been feeling increasingly under siege over the last 2 years. I mean, I know this. I mean, I'm in contact with some of them, and they are becoming increasingly frightened. This attack is going to make them feel even more frightened. They are going to become more afraid and more angry as a result. And of course, there's enormous anger on the other side that has been building up too. And we have very large Muslim communities in Britain.
America is changing,
and they are becoming increasingly restive and restless and angry about the situation in Gaza. And unfortunately, this is a tinderbox now. And I really do hope we can find a way back.
I do too, but one of my fears is that both sides are going to seize on this and. I can just imagine that Netanyahu, who, just like he jumped all over when two Jewish people were killed here in Washington, D.C. and shot in front of the Jewish Holocaust Museum, is evidence that, see, we're being unjustly accused and targeted here and there. So we need to take stronger actions against this. And as you pointed out, the Muslim community is already feeling like they're under siege. And I just really fear that the volatility could go in a direction that's bad for everybody.
It's bad for everybody. And I mean, it's important to say that Britain is going through a difficult period economically. There is little confidence in the government. And there is anyway a rise in social tensions generally. So adding this kind of tension, Jewish people versus Muslim people, on top of all of that, I'm afraid it's a nightmare prospect, and one which I really hope we can pull back from. It's important to stress again, I mean, this is a terrible crime and a terrible thing that was done, and very upsetting, and very upsetting that it's happened, very upsetting to me that it's happened in my own country.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. And we have some experience with that here in our own country, my own city here just months ago. So we'll certainly keep an eye on this. And as always, we are very, very grateful to you for coming on today. And tell everybody that, because I know a lot of the folks here don't get enough of you on our show. So by all means, especially since we have 250,000 people now signed up to our show, that you need to go to Alexander's show here on the Durand. And a lot of great stuff. I was actually watching your show just a couple of days ago on that. So I recommend other people go and do the same.
Thank you very much, Daniel, and a great pleasure to be on your show as well.
Always the same here. Look forward to having you next time. And just one final thank you to you folks. We did. Just this morning, we eclipsed 250,000 subscribers to the channel, and we owe it all to you. One of the big reasons is because what we always often ask you to do is to share this channel with the people on our podcast that we have or on our Substack, et cetera. And you've been doing it, and we are really, really grateful for all that you've been doing. And we hope to continue to provide unintimidated and uncompromised information because we know that's what you want and deserve. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.